We have next, we have Dr. Adam Ghazali. Is Adam Ghazali? Ghazali. 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 Ghazali was born and raised in New York City. He obtained an MD and a PhD degree in neuroscience at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York. His doctoral research focused on receptor plasticity in the hippocampus in normal aging. This research earned him the prestigious 1997 Cortical Scholar Award. He then completed a clinical residency in neurology at the University of Pennsylvania. Following residency, he traveled to UC Berkeley for a cognitive neuroscience research fellowship and a clinical fellowship in cognitive neurology at the UCSF Memory and Aging Center. Dr. Ghazali is currently an assistant professor in the departments of neurology and physiology at UCSF and the director of UCSF Neuroscience Imaging Center. He's also the director of the Cognizant Neuroscience Laboratory, which I got to go see. It's really cool. At the Mission Bay campus, which focuses on understanding the neural mechanisms of memory and attention in humans, how these processes change with normal aging and dementia, and how we might intervene to improve cognitive abilities. He's also here with his fellow neuroscientist, Daria Pino, who, by the way, has a wonderful blog with lots of great nutrition info called Summer Tomatoes. So thank you very much, Adam, or Dr. Ghazali, for joining us. And here you go.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Patty, for inviting me, and it's a pleasure to be here. This is a tremendously amazing place to give a lecture. Before I start, I'd like to get a little information about my audience since I study aging and the brain. Let's start by a show of hands if you're over the age of 50. All right, okay, that helps. So who in this audience feels that at times their cognitive abilities, their, let's say memory, was not up to the level that might have been in the past that they might want it to be today? Wow, almost exactly the same number of people. All right, so what I'm going to do today is take you on a little tour of the aging brain and mind. I'm going to tell you, as opposed to some of our previous talks, which were fantastic and told you a lot about what you can do, I'm going to tell you about a lot about what's going on, what's changing as you get older. I'm going to tell you about my research here at UCSF, and then I'm going to give you some advice that's really mimicking a lot of what you already heard and tell you about some of the research we're doing to see if we could figure out better what can be done as you get older. So let me tell you about my research motivation. So I started working on aging research at the age of 22 when I was a first-year grad student in New York and sort of just fell into the project. At the age of 22, you never really think you're going to get older, so you're not as interested in doing this. But I fell into the project, and I've worked on aging ever since. And this is really the motivation for a lot of the work that I've been doing over the years. The first is one that's probably obvious to all of you. I'm sure you all know the statistics that the baby boomers have reached 60 years old and our population is aging. There's just an interesting study that came out from the NIH. This is not a property of the United States. This is worldwide that the older population is increasing, largest in developing countries. But this is a serious issue both at the societal level as well as the individual level of what is happening to our brains and, of course, our entire health, although my focus is on the brain as we get older. But what really has become obvious to me is that this is only one of the inspirations for studying what happens as we get older. The second is that what I'm noticing is that expectations of what we should be capable of as we get older is changing. So I see older adults at the Memory and Aging Center at UCSF, and it seems that now people just no longer satisfied getting older. I mean, there was a time where people were more likely to retire, more likely to spend years sitting on the couch watching TV as opposed to showing up to stimulating lectures in the middle of the day. I see my older subjects wanting to learn another language because they're visiting Spain, so they might as well know Spanish. People learning to play musical instruments, and in general, wanting to keep their abilities at the same level that they enjoyed throughout their life. So are there people in the room that share this type of mentality? I'm sure it's not It's not surprising, especially in this audience, but this is a growing expectation that people do not want their brains to age. They want to live the same sort of healthy brain style that they've become used to throughout their lives. So despite these ambitious goals, we know that the brain changes as we get older across many different abilities. I'm going to tell you all about that. And because of these goals and because the brain does change, like every organ system in the body, even very mild changes in cognitive abilities lead to a decrease in the quality of life, and people are just not willing to accept that. So we have this tremendous burden as scientists and the medical community, as we help people live longer, which we know we have largely over the last century, we now have the burden of helping people live better and really fulfill their expectations for how they want to live their lives. So my research has really been trying to find what are the basic changes that occur in the brain that underlie these changes in cognition and our thinking abilities as we get older, and that's what I'm going to tell you about. I'm going to just define a couple terms I always find helpful when I interact with an audience of people that might not have a lot of background in this, because you hear these terms thrown around and they're important to clarify. The first is normal aging. This is a term that is defined very differently. It tends to be used for things that occur universally, independent of disease. So they occur as you get older, like menopause. If it doesn't happen, it's actually abnormal. Before I do that, just one more point about normal aging. What we tend to refer to as normal aging when we do our research, and a lot of what I'm going to talk today is about normal aging, it's really healthy aging, and it's usual aging. It's the aging that happens to most people. But despite healthy lifestyles and a lot of the things that you heard about to keep yourself healthy, there are these changes that occur that are independent of disease processes. And that's what really I'm going to focus on. What are these things that happen if you don't get Alzheimer's disease? Mild cognitive impairment. Has anyone heard this term? MCI. So this term is becoming increasingly used. And what this describes is a decrease in cognitive abilities that are not normal. They're different than most of your friends or people of your age. And they start impairing how you are functioning. But they haven't quite reached the level where you can't work or shop or drive. Once they reach that level, they become called something else. They become called dementia. So let me just put up these two terms. So this is a frequent question that I'm asked. What's the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's disease, right? This is a common question that you might have or friends you might have are curious about this. Dementia is not a disease. It's a syndrome. And a syndrome is a collection of symptoms or signs. So there are many different types of syndromes. The syndrome of dementia means that you have a decline in your thinking ability. That can't just be memory. If it's memory alone, it's amnesia. But it's memory and something else, your spatial abilities, your attention, your abilities to multitask, something we call executive functions. When a number of these abilities decline and it reaches a level where you're impaired, that's when we classify that person as having dementia. If they're not quite impaired yet, but we notice the decline, then we say they have mild cognitive impairment. Alzheimer's disease is one cause of dementia. Granted, it is by far the most common cause, and that's why they're often thought of as synonyms, but they're not. There are other things that cause dementia, so less commonly, vascular disease being a very common one also. But things like Parkinson's disease, frontal temporal dementia, and others also cause dementia. So that's just a little overview of some terms that we in the medical community throw out very quickly, but they're not always so well defined. So let me talk to you about normal aging. This is largely the focus of my research. Some people have taken the thought, and this is a quite famous picture from the past, that aging sort of occurs like a hill, that you start out in sort of the peak as a child, and you raise to some level of adulthood, and then you go through sort of a decline, a degeneration, and it sort of travels this hill. So we look sometimes through the literature and try to see the scientific literature and see, are there abilities that also follow this type of pattern? And there actually are. So what we have here is speed. And by speed, I mean speed of processing. How fast you can take in information and how fast you can react to the world around you. And this does increase and then decline across the lifespan, similar to this sort of hill that we grew here. Another one is called executive function. Executive function are things like multitasking, ability to organize and to plan and to switch, the type of things that you use when you're really engaged in life in a very active way. So this also follows the same pattern. I'd like to point out, though, that this peak is not at the age of 60, right? This peak is around the age of 20. So the concept of what aging is shifting radically. I've given some aging talks on this topic, and the audience is full of 30-year-olds and 40-year-olds who realize that aging is a lifelong process that starts right after development, which probably peaks in its early 20s. So you can see that a lot of these things are not about being 60 or 70 or even over 50. They're about just passing your early 20s. And so we could see that a lot of these declines. If you look at other types of cognitive abilities, like long-term memory, working memory is that ability to hold information in mind for very short periods of time and then use it. Like if someone tells you a phone number and you're just trying to hold it in just to get it back into the phone, these things decline right across the whole lifespan, starting at early 20s. So this is this concept that aging is really part of most of your adult life. The majority of it is this aging process that has this very linear trend in a lot of ways. But not to paint an entirely bleak picture about your brain and getting older, there are some cognitive abilities that have been shown to be remarkably stable. For instance, vocabulary. Also, semantic, episodic memory. So information about the world around you, like facts, like presidents and different semantic facts as well as vocabulary, seem to stay steady or maybe even increase as you get older. And then there are some things, some cognitive abilities that are sometimes harder to define that might actually improve with age, such as wisdom, the ability to take your experience and your intelligence and integrate them and have better decision-making abilities. So, and certainly in some respects, you know, these things actually improve with age. So that's what we understand what happens in the mind, which I think of as what the brain does in terms of cognition. But what happens in the brain, the structure and the chemistry and of the brain itself? Well, the first thing we observe, which is quite salient, is that the size of the brain shrinks. So if you have an MRI scan and you're over 50, certainly if you're over 60, it's most likely going to have a little note at the bottom, just to cover everyone's butts there, that the size of the brain is atrophied expected for age. Right, so we know this is the curve. The red are women, and red are males, and the blue are females, and you could see that the size of the brain, starting here very young in life, this is age 9 through 12, and this is age 80, decreases throughout life. For a long time, we looked at this as a really dismal picture, and we thought that it meant that we were losing brain cells. You've probably heard this every time you have a great night out. How many brain cells have you lost? Was it really worth it? You want to know exactly how many cells you lost. But what we now realize is that that's not actually true, that the number of cells in the brain are fairly preserved. This is even some work that I was involved in as a grad student, as you go through life. And a lot of this is actually shrinkage of the brain, that large cells are becoming smaller. And the connections between brain areas that have a lot of water in them, the myelin, is becoming smaller. So I think that's a lot more optimistic. If the brain is largely there, the branching decreases a little bit, but that stuff is plastic. Has everyone heard of this term, plasticity? That's the ability of the brain to remodel itself, to change when it's stimulated. A lot of that continues throughout life. So I think that we have a lot more optimism now thinking about the aging brain, especially independent of disease. But there are other changes that occur. So we know that there are changes in these things called neurotransmitters, and neurotransmitters are the chemicals that communicate between brain cells. And there are many of them, acetylcholine, dopamine, glutamate. They do decrease in their quantity as well as receptor changes as people get older. And this becomes a lot of the potential places that we can act therapeutically, either through natural means or through medications to stimulate these systems. A lot of these are the exact same systems that our medications work on in things like depression and Parkinson's disease and most of our other psychiatric and neurological disorders. What are the changes that occur in aging? They are significant, and is this possibly a place that we might act is something that is being considered on many levels. There are also changes in the structure of the brain. The white matter, if you could think of the brain, the cortex of the brain are this concentration of neurons, and they're connected with each other through these tracks that are essentially like highways. This is also thought of as the white matter. And you see this white over here? This really shouldn't be here, this sort of fluffy stuff. And what this shows is damage to this area, probably caused by lack of oxygen. If you have things like high blood pressure, diabetes, if you don't exercise, smoke, obesity, this is much worse. And what this is that these little teeny vessels that supply the white matter become damaged. If you have those diseases, they're much more likely to be damaged. But even just living to the age of 80 or even beyond 60, there is some damage that seems to occur even if you're living super healthy. Our brain wasn't under the same evolutionary pressure to live to the age of 80 or 90. People did not live that long throughout evolution. And so there are certain changes that occur in every organ system that just show the passage of time and this damage that occurs. It doesn't mean that there's nothing we can do about it, but it is incredibly common. So what I just did there was give you a very brief snapshot of some of our latest views of what occurs in our brains and our minds as we get older, independent of diseases like Alzheimer's and other causes of dementia. I'm going to tell you a little about the tools of cognitive neuroscience. Cognitive neuroscience is what I do in my lab and our lab does. It's the ability, it is the process of studying how the brain forms the mind, essentially. What are the actual chemical and structural and functional changes that occur in your brain that allow you to operate in the world? And we're trying to understand that. And this has largely been studied in animals, in experimental animals, and now, due to new tools, we can study this in people. And in our lab, we really only study people, and we engage them in these experiments I'm going to show you, and we record their brain activity. So one tool that we use is functional MRI. So who here has heard of functional MRI? Okay, functional MRI is like MRI, but instead of just looking at the structure of the brain, we see blood flow, which is a correlate. It associates with neural activity. So what you do, and this is what our research participants do, and most of them are in their 60s or in their 20s. We tend to compare those two groups just to give us a picture about what might be happening. You lay inside the scanner. Who's been in an MRI scanner? Oh, wow, that's a lot of people. So it's just like being an MRI scanner, sort of noisy and a little uncomfortable, but we try to make it a little better because instead of just lying there in the dark, you're actually looking at a screen. There's a mirror, and you can see past, and you see a screen, and presenting you with experiments, just like psychological experiments. You see different pictures. You have to remember certain things. You have to ignore certain things. So we could present visual. We could present sounds. And then we record this measure of brain activity, but we can also record your motor responses, how many you get right. We could look at your eye movements. We could look at your respiration rate, your pulse. We can do EEG. So this allows us to get this really sort of science fiction way of studying, you know, what even 20 years ago was really just the realm of science fiction, to study what is going on inside your brain while you're doing all these amazing things like attention and memory and learning and language and things of that nature. MRI is a pretty amazing tool that has just continued to explode in the information that it delivers. So this is some data from our scanner at UCSF, and this is the view of the vessels in the brain without any dye injected, just using MRI, and you can see how detailed it is. Our ability, this is some data from our lab. This is not just blobs of activity, which is largely what fMRI shows. What this is blobs of connectivity, and it's showing you when your eyes are closed and you're just trying to imagine someone's face, what is the connections that are involved in creating that? So we could see all these things that occur even when you're not doing anything overtly. These lines over here are not vessels. These are axons, which are now imaged through a new technique called diffusion tensor imaging, DTI. And it lets us see all these highways and connections in the brain. Again, a very new technique. And over here we have just the standard MRI. And even this has been pushed to an extreme, that we can see detailed structures of the brain down to the size of a cubic millimeter. So we now have these very, very amazing tools to understand the structure and the function of the brain while you're engaged in activities. In our lab, here's our scanner over here. It's on the Parnassus campus. It's going to be moving to Mission Bay, the new UCSF campus. There's our scanner, one of my students recording activity from one of our participants. We also record activity with something called EEG. Is everyone familiar with EEG? EEG is this cap that goes on, and it allows us to see. You could see doing an EEG experiment makes you very happy. If you want to be in one of our experiments, we're always looking for participants. And what EEG does is it allows us to record when things are occurring in the brain. So fMRI is really good to see where things are happening, but it's not quite as fast as the brain actually operates. While EEG, on the other hand, is very fast, but it doesn't allow us to see exactly where things occur. So we tend to use both of these measures. All right, I'm going to give you an overview of research in our lab. We tend to think of our research as having three different streams. The first is we try to figure out how does it work. And it, we mean the brain in general, and I'm going to tell you specifically right after this. And to do that, we couple all these tools, functional MRI, EEG, a tool called transcranial magnetic stimulation, which I'm not going to talk about today, but it allows us to stimulate parts of the brain using a magnetic pulse and then see what that part does when it's sort of perturbed for a second. It's a pretty exciting way to explore the brain in another way. But once we understand what is happening in the brain, then we say, what goes wrong? What changes to allow people to not function in the optimal way that they wish to? So we explore what happens in both normal aging and what happens when you have dementia. In our lab, we tend to look at the earliest signs of dementia. So I run a clinic at UCSF. It's a mild cognitive impairment clinic. So I see pretty much older adults that are really concerned, and they're family members are concerned, but they're still functioning. Most of them are still working, but they feel like something is not right. Just lost that car in the drive, you know, in the parking lot one too many times, left the pot on the water. Something is concerning them. And it's very hard for us at this stage to figure out if it's normal or if it's not normal. And that's one of the biggest challenges I feel that we face now in this research, is trying to distinguish that early enough, because we all know that the best chance we have of intervening is to act early. So that's a real important issue. But that wouldn't be enough, right? We want to understand what changes, but then we want to figure out what we can do to drive the brain back to an optimal state so that we can give everyone their wish of keeping their brain active and healthy throughout their lives. So if we could use these same markers to understand how the brain works, understand how it changes, and then understand what we can do to optimize the brain, that would be the service that we're trying to make. And that's sort of how research works in our lab. I'm going to tell you a little bit about all three of these now. So to tell you a little bit about my particular area of research, I became very interested in both attention and memory. Attention and memory have often been put in separate categories as if they were not related to each other. So there are textbooks about how you pay attention, textbooks how your memory works, but very few researchers had been really looking at the interface of these two things. But we know in our experience that they're very related. So if you look at this picture over here, you see this young woman reading a book, and you see, let's focus on this guy right over here sitting at this table. And if you ask yourself the question, who's more likely to remember the details of what their experience, everyone would say this young woman, right? So we know that our memory and our ability to capture an event and hold it over time is related to what's going on at the time that you experience it. And I'm going to talk about that a little more. I thought that any good presentation should have a fine lecture, a fine quote. So I spent hours and hours on Google trying to find someone that talked about how attention and memory related to each other. And it was very hard to actually find this. This is actually a quote by Samuel Johnson, who's a writer in the 1700s, a British writer, and he writes what I thought was really amazing, because I could find very little of this in the actual psychological or neuroscientific literature. And what he says is that the true art of memory is the art of attention, that no man will read with much advantage who is not able at pleasure to evacuate his mind. If the repositories of thought are already full, what can they receive? And if the mind is employed on the past or the future, the book will be held before the eyes in vain. So you might have all had this experience as you're trying to take in information, what's already in your mind and what's going on around you. And that's really what my research focuses on. So I'm going to give you my conceptual overview of how I feel we interact with the world in this regard. So perception, how we perceive the world around us, is not a passive process. The world just doesn't flood into your brain against your will, just passively. It's influenced by attention. And there are really two types of attention that influence your perception. The first is external, stimulus-driven attention. So if there's a loud sound or a flash of light, or even if someone says your name quietly behind you, you pay attention whether or not that was your goal, right? So that's stimulus-driven attention, that the world can command your attention independent of your goals. The other type of attention is internal goal-directed attention. It's the attention that you're doing right now. You're choosing to pay attention, and thus you're listening and looking at the slides. All of your interactions with the world is a balance between these two competing forces, the world sort of imposing itself upon you and you trying to impose your goals and how you perceive the world. So another way of looking at this is top-down modulation. Top-down from the top of the hierarchy is how you perceive the world, and I'll tell you about the modulation in a second, and the bottom-up is the sort of the environment flowing into you. What I'm interested in is in how this two competing forces go on and influence how you remember things in the world and how that might change as we get older, both in the long term and in the short term. So let's return to this and place this in a little less abstract setting. Let's look at this gentleman over here and say that he should be involved in this conversation, right? So he's with these other three people for dinner, and his top-down goals in the blue, we're going to say, is to pay attention. If he has any chance of remembering his conversation the next day, his attention should be focused over here. But there's some sort of bottom-up stimulus in the room, right? Maybe there's an altercation here, and it's strong enough to pull the attention of other people in the room. But what's interesting, and you could see his attention is pulled to, what's interesting is this woman over here seems to be so engaged in her text message that even though she's closest to this, she's still able to focus. So what we see here is that there's really two things going on. And that's what I'm going to tell you about, these two faces of top-down modulation. There's both focus, which you could see here is accomplished successfully, and the ability to ignore, which is failing here. Our research is now telling us that focus and ignoring are not just two sides of the same coin, but they're actually dissociable. That you might be focusing just fine, but what you're failing at is ignoring. So I'm going to show you some research from our lab now. What this occurs and what we think is happening in the brain, this is a view of our brain. Our eyeballs would be right over here. And when you see things in the world around you, the first part of your cortex that responds to it is actually the back part of your brain, the visual cortex. And then information travels forward where it gets more integrated. So that's what allows you to see more and more complex things in the world. We think that there are signals from the front part of your brain that project down and modulate the activity for when things are relevant or when they're not relevant. I wanted to tell you a little bit about the front part of the brain. It's been mentioned a couple times in our previous talks, the prefrontal cortex. There was a period of time where we thought that maybe this part of the brain did not do much at all, which is sort of a silly thought to think that the brain just has extra areas just hanging around. But this really changed in September of 1948. Is everyone familiar with the story of Phineas Gage? It's a pretty famous story. I'm going to tell it to you. So Phineas Gage was a 25-year-old and had this very sort of prestigious job. He was working as a railroad foreman in Vermont. And one of his jobs that he would do is after everyone set everything up, he'd go around and make sure that the gunpowder and then all the packing sand was in place. And he would tamp it down and make sure that everything was ready so that they could do their blasting to build the railroad. And these tamping irons were massive, 3'7" long, 13 pounds. And he apparently was distracted, which is sort of ironic for the nature of this talk. But a spark occurred, which drove this tamping iron through his head. It penetrated below his left eye, through the top of the skull, and it landed 60 feet behind him. So that's a pretty phenomenal event, but probably the most phenomenal aspect of it was that he barely lost consciousness. It's not actually sure that he did lose consciousness. He was taken to a hospital. He survived, and he seemed to recover fine. And he was able to move and able to act and remember and had all these preserved abilities. And everyone's like, see, the front part of your brain does nothing. But what they found was very shocking was that what changed was him. He was no longer Gage. And these are some notes that were written by his physician at the time. And here's, you could see the size of this tamping iron, and here's actually his skull, and you could see that that never fully healed. So they said he was fitful, irreverent, indulging in times with the grossest profanity, impatient of restraint and advice when it conflicted with his desire, obstinate, devising many plans of operation which are no sooner arranged than they are abandoned and turns for others that appear more feasible. Basically, the balance between his intellectual faculties and his animal propensities seemed to have been destroyed. And this relates to what we heard about the prefrontal cortex. This is your control part of the brain. And that's why I think it came up many times when we talked about control of appetite and decision making. This is the part that allows you to exercise restraint. All types of restraint. Restraints in behavior, which you could see here. This was a very sort of pious church-going guy, and he became a very, very different person. His ability to restrain himself in social circumstances declined markedly. We're looking at not just the control of your behavior, but the control of how you perceive the world. And more interestingly, or, you know, sort of more relevant to this talk, is that it's this part of the brain that might be changing the most as we get older. Maybe not to this extreme, although sometimes it does seem to occur that way, but in some levels that this is what's breaking down, and that's what a lot of our research is showing us. So another interesting thing about the frontal lobes is that it's the most human part of your brain. It is the part of your brain that has developed the most throughout evolution. It's looking at even monkeys, even the great apes have much less developed frontal lobes compared to the rest of our brain, which is rather more similar. It's also the last part to develop as you get older. If you look at children, they're very bottom up. just like animals can often be. They might have a goal, and then you show them like a piece of candy, and all of a sudden they have a whole new goal, right? Easily switch over. They have the inability to hold that top-down modulation, that goal, despite the fact that their environment is impinging upon them. So we think that it's this front part of the brain that allows you to have that top-down modulation. Okay, I'm going to tell you an experiment in our lab now that has been going on for probably like 6 years, and we have some other versions of it. And it's a group, this is while I was working at Berkeley, at UC Berkeley. It's a group of younger participants, age 18 to 30, and a group of older participants, age 60 to 80. We considered a study of normal aging, and that's largely because the group of older adults were very healthy. They had no medical conditions, despite the fact that they did see physicians. They were on no medications. They had no history of depression or dementia. So in some senses, they weren't exactly normal, right? They were super normal. And we really wanted to sort of find the best people that they could be doing in this age group and see what was happening in this population. Okay. So I am going to show you one version of this experiment now. I'm going to have you do it in your seats, all right? So this is an experiment that we've done many times, probably on over 100 people now, and we've published many papers showing what this might mean in terms of attention and memory and how they interact. So here's what the experiment's going to be. You're going to see four pictures in a row. Two of them are going to be faces, and two of them are going to be natural scenes, like Yosemite picture. And you are to ignore the scenes, because I'm not going to test you on them, but you should remember both faces. Then there's going to be an X on the screen, and 9 seconds are going to pass. During that time, try to remember the faces, and then a face is going to come up. And your question is that one of the two faces that you saw? If you're doing this experiment lying in our scanner, you'd press the right button for you saw it, and you'd press the left button for no, that's a new face. All right, does everyone get it? Okay, so here they come. They'll be around 1 a second. They come pretty fast, though, and then there'll be the break, and then there's going to be the question. So is that the face? It was not the face. Now, if you're sitting there and saying, I thought that was the face, there's no reason to be nervous. This was only one trial. Everyone has to practice this, right? Even our youngest, healthiest, most vital participants don't do 100% on this task, and everyone needs some practice rounds. So what we're most interested in, though, is not if you get it right or wrong. It's what's occurring in your brain while you're looking at those pictures, both the relevant and the irrelevant ones. So let me show you what this experiment looks like. So this is the one you did, right? So this is like sort of a view from the sky on what you did. You saw two faces and two scenes, and then there was a break period, and then you had to say if this face matched one of these. You would do that like 30 times, and then you'd do another experiment. Same exact stimuli. Two faces and two scenes, but now you'd have to remember the scenes, ignore the faces, and then say if the scene matched one of these here, you would say it did. And then there's a third condition where you just look at the faces and the scenes. There's no memory test, and this forms our baseline. So if we look what happens in the brain over here, if there's any difference in activity in the visual parts of the brain between these tasks, it must be top-down modulation. It's your ability to shape how you perceive the world, because if you were, let's say, anesthetized and just looking at these streams, they would be exactly the same because you're seeing the same amount of information. But this is how top-down modulation works. You have more or less activity depending on its relevance. So let me show you what it looks like. Here is, okay, and we look in this area of the brain here. I won't go into detail here. And this is a brain, area of your brain that's selective for looking at scenes in the world around you. So we can compare how much activity there is when you're looking at scenes compared to when you're just passively viewing scenes compared to when you should have been ignoring scenes, which was that experiment that you did. So let's take a look. So this is what we see in the younger subjects. So we look at their brains, and we could see that when they're trying to remember the scenes, there's this very bold response, a lot of activity. And when they are trying to ignore scenes, there's less activity. Every single person that has ever done this study shows this difference. Even though they're looking at the same number of scenes, they have more activity when they're trying to remember it, less activity when they're trying to ignore it. Interesting, when they're just passively viewing it, it goes right in the middle. And what this gives is a measure of enhancement, how much you could ramp up activity when something is relevant, but also how much you can suppress activity when it's irrelevant to what's going on around you. So we published this paper and showed these markers of enhancement and suppression. And then we did the exact same study in a group of those healthy older adults. And I don't know if some of you want to guess or know this finding, but I'll just jump into it. What we found, interestingly, was that the older adults enhance exactly as if they were 20 years old. The difference between the relevant information and the passive information was the same as the younger adults. But what was very different was the ability to suppress the irrelevant information. So basically what we're saying is in that experiment that you did, older subjects were not ignoring those scenes that came up to the same degree that the younger subjects were, even though it was not their goal, right? The goal was just to remember the faces. And younger subjects, when they were confronted with that, ignore the scenes. But the older adults allowed much more of that in. And what really pulled this together was we found that there's a direct relationship. Over here is the accuracy, how well they did on the experiment. And here is how well they ignored the scenes, the suppression abilities. And you can see that those older adults that suppressed well had memory close in the 90 to 100%. They were no different from the younger population. But those older adults that were not ignoring the scenes did not remember the faces as well. So what this shows us is that you only have a limited capacity in your brain. And if you're trying to focus on something and you take in things that are not relevant, it will cause interference and give you a decreased ability to remember the things that are relevant to your goals. Interestingly enough, we just finished a study with a collaborator on children, 8 to 14 years old. There's a very healthy population of kids. And what it found was that they did suppress. They did not have a suppression deficit. And you could see they're all here on the right side of zero. Although they did have the same very strong relationship between those children that ignored better did better on the test. And those that ignored the irrelevant information less well did more poorly. We're now very interested in if children that have ADHD might be the ones that also have the same suppression deficit that we see in our older subjects. Just one other piece of information before I move on. We went back and we asked, after they finished the experiment, we showed them all the pictures that they saw during the experiment and a whole set of new ones. And we say, do you remember seeing this picture? Rate it on a scale from 1, I did not see it, to 4, I definitely saw it. What we find, interestingly, is that older adults that perform poorly on the working memory test remember the scenes. Remember the scenes that you should have been ignoring. They remember those scenes when they get out of the scanner better than the older adults that seem to be performing better on the working memory test. And they remember those scenes better than the young adults. So what you see is that they have better memory for things they should not have been remembering. So what we learn from this is that it's not so simple to just say that memory is declining. And it's very complicated. We have to always take into account how you interact with the world in terms of your attention and what you're trying to remember. Just one other follow-up to this study. We also were curious, how quickly does this occur? What is the timing of this? Those pictures are up for a second. In your brain, a second is a very long time. There are many, many processes that occur without your awareness in that second. So we used EEG, where we could hook a cap up to one of our older participants here. They did exactly the same experiment, and we looked at the timing of this enhancement and suppression. And what we found was that younger adults suppress those irrelevant scenes in the first 1/10 of a second that it's present. Very, very fast. And that's where the older adults were not suppressing. At the end of the second, in the second half of the second, the older and younger adults actually looked really similar to each other. So from this, we learn that it's not just important to ignore things that are relevant. It's important to do it rapidly. That if you let that in, it already causes its damage. So this is where the processing speed comes into effect. That the ability to react rapidly to the world when things are realized to not be relevant is really important for your performance. So from this, we learn that the front part of the brain, and we have a whole lot of research I'm not telling you about, is sort of like a bouncer at like a restaurant or a bar or a club. And what this bouncer does is it restricts the amount of information that makes it to the sensory parts of your brain. And they're sort of like this nightclub that has a limited room. It's actually much smaller than this. They're really only room for around 7 numbers, 4 simple visual images. A lot of researchers now think for a complex visual image, there's only room for 1 at a time, like a face. So you can see that if you can't restrict this area by using this front part of your brain, then this information comes in and affects memory. And that's something that we're learning again and again every time we do a study, is a really strong influence on memory. Okay, we know that this ability to filter and its failure has an impact on daily activities. Has anyone ever walked up to the refrigerator and had this face on? Where just 8 seconds ago you knew what you wanted to get when you left the couch, But now as you reach the refrigerator, you have no idea. I found this ad over here, a cartoon. I thought it was sort of funny. I don't know if you could see from back of the room. It says, "No, I'm not tired. Just trying to remember why we're going upstairs." Aside from these two examples, this affects conversation, the ability to drive, the ability to interact in almost every way that you want to, especially when you're at work and trying to compete in a very busy workplace with other people that are functioning at a very high level. We're now studying all these different types of interference, and the more we think about it, the more types of interference exist. So there's both internal interference, right? You don't have to be distracted by something out in the world around you. You could be distracted by something inside. We hear this complaint all the time. You're going to do something, and you can't stop thinking about something that's bothering you. So you might have mind wanderings, or you might have diversions, things that you remember that are relevant that, you know, oh, I left something on the stove, that also take you away. And then external distractions that we've been talking about, both distractions, things that are irrelevant, as well as interruptions. Maybe you're on your way to do something and the phone rings. How do you get back to what you were doing? In terms of interruptions, this has become very interesting. So what I describe as sort of an explosion of creative interference. The amount of distractions that exist around us seem to just be increasing exponentially. I don't know those of you that have iPhones, but the obvious things of texts and pagers and beepers and things going off, or computers with pop-up windows that pull you away from your main goals. I thought this was sort of funny. The iPhone has these apps, I don't know if you're familiar with, that allows you to do all these, sort of turns your phone into a little laptop. And there's this app that came out that allows you, there's a camera on the back of the iPhone that allows you to take pictures. Well, this person figured out how to use this camera to allow you to walk, like walking your dog, and also do emails at the same time. So, you know, I don't know how seriously this is meant to be taken, but a lot of people have downloaded this app. And we see that people are just trying to push themselves more and more into doing as many things as possible within the same segment of time. You could just imagine it's not long until your emails just reflected onto your, you know, windscreen, you know, the windshield of your car, and you could sort of text while you're at the light. I think it's a serious issue, and we know that this capacity in the brain, and it's being exceeded not just in older adults, but we have a whole series of experiments that show that the same thing happens with children and young adults that are frequently overloaded on the amount of information that they can multitask. So I think this is something that's going to be much more evident as sort of this computer world continues. Okay, I'm just going to give you a little bit about preventing and delaying this. You've already heard a lot about it. I don't have all that much to say. We just started entering this world from a research perspective. But I do read the literature in this, and I am interested in it. And it seems that there are some things that keep coming up again and again, and they're getting an accumulation of evidence. A lot of these are not done, as we talked about, in controlled studies, and I think that's very important. Sometimes we're led astray by epidemiological studies in that they're not causal, and that happens all the time. But I think that as a research community, we're pretty secure in that these things are the type of activities that lead to a healthier brain and healthier cognition. So the first is nutrition. We've heard so much about it. I'm not going to go into it in detail, but we know that the Mediterranean diet has a lot of evidence, even very recently, in its relation to Alzheimer's disease. We've talked about the ingredients of fish and vegetables and fruits and whole grains, wine in some moderation, as well as olive oil, the omega-3s and the importance of that in the fish and in the diet. So I think that there is an accumulation of evidence. How these things work in isolation as opposed to together is a big question and a really, really challenging question, right? It's hard to put people on controlled studies where they only eat fish or they never eat fish, right? So evidence in this is slow to accumulate, but I think that there is a general impression that this is all of these ingredients are good for your brain. Physical exercise. I can't emphasize this strongly enough. It's probably the number one prescription that we give at the Memory and Aging Center at UCSF, no matter what your affliction may be in terms of your cognitive ability. Everyone leaves with a strong recommendation to engage in exercise, both cardiovascular, sort of what's classically thought as aerobic exercise, as well as weight training. I think that there's more and more evidence. This does not appear to be just mediated by increasing blood flow to the brain, but also increasing maybe even the genesis of new brain cells and increasing growth factors. So I think we'll just learn more and more about how exercise helps the brain. So it's certainly something that we always encourage. This is a thorny subject. So mental exercise. I don't think that there's any doubt that keeping your brain active is good for it. But how you keep it active is probably very important, just like physical fitness, right? It didn't take long to realize that there are specialized machines in the gym that are better and maybe better for some people than other people, depending on what their weaknesses are. And we're learning about this at a rapid rate, that's also true for the brain. There's been a lot of sort of press early on about crossword puzzles and Sudoku and these type of brain activities, and now there's some evidence that maybe they don't actually do that much. Not that they necessarily hurt you, but these are the type of exercises that don't really pull in and make new connections form or force you to use your brain in a different way, in a more flexible way, just maybe asking you to remember things that you already knew at one time. So there are a number of companies I want to give. So I think there's still a question about this. Posit Science is one company. We actually have some collaborations with them. And they're an example of a company that is approaching this in what I think is a very good way and trying to approach a lot of it like a medication. So we know that there are things you can do. Some might be better than others. Let's compare them. Let's have some people do crossword puzzles and some people do this special attention exercise. Does this really help people, or is it just like all of it's not so bad for you, but not really going to help you? We're still at the very beginning of this. Posit does have some evidence, and I think that's really a great thing, but there is a lot of lack of evidence out there, right? You don't have to show efficacy of a brain training program to get it approved. It's not like a medication. So I just, you know, caution you all to use logic and see what information is available before spending a lot of money or doing things that might take a lot of time. In general, I think that we will be very pleased at how this ends up in the next decade or so. But right now, we're still sort of at the beginning of it. Okay, I'm just about to wrap up. This is a really strong piece of advice that I don't actually have all that much evidence for. It's largely based on animal research. But what I like to encourage people here is to step out of the comfort zone. It's very easy. You sort of spend your whole life trying to get comfortable. And once you're finally comfortable, we go ahead and tell you, don't be so comfortable. And that's because when you challenge yourself as you grow up and as teenagers do, they're constantly putting themselves in situations that are uncomfortable. And we know very well that the brain responds efficiently and effectively and dynamically to being challenged. So it's important to challenge yourself. Now, maybe this picture is a little bit extreme, but there are certainly other things you can do. Just even being involved in very dynamic social interactions, traveling, forcing yourself to figure out a new currency or how to get around an airport in another city. These are the things that I think are probably some of the best things you could do to keep your brain healthy as you get older. Just to wrap up with just two slides, what we're doing in our lab to help is that we're using brain recordings and then interventions. Some things we're looking at are medications, like the medications that we use to treat Alzheimer's disease, but also cognitive training. So we have a collaboration with Posit Science to see if we can understand how do those things actually help the brain, and then we record brain activity after and figure out what has changed. In our lab, we also have an experiment. I actually designed this video game that's now finally funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and what this video game is supposed to do is to teach you how to ignore better. Since we know that ignoring is so important for memory, what this game is, it's like a car driving game, and you're racing along, and signs are popping out at you, and you have to ignore a lot of them and pay attention to some of them. And we think that this will train that ability, and if you could ignore better, you'll remember better. So we're doing this with both EEG testing, and here's our EEG room. And then our older participants are taking home a laptop, and they're going to play this. And we're going to record activity while they play it, and then they come back to the lab. And we're going to see, does the ability to ignore improve, and does that lead to better memory? We also have now in development an EEG cap that you can actually take home with you, and it will send wirelessly your brain activity to the computer so we can record that as you train. So this is really cutting-edge stuff that we're really excited about, and if anyone wants to be involved, we'll be looking. We'll probably be starting the study in the next month or two, and we're definitely looking for lots of people. So I think that this is the direction that we want to take to really study how these things work in a very rigorous scientific way. So I want to close there. I want to thank you all for your attention and, of course, your lack of attention, other things. I just want to quickly, without going through the names, just to show all the people that are involved in the research that we do in this tons. And I want to give a special thanks to Daria Pino, who's my nutritional consultant, who's here today. And once again, thank Patty, and thank you all for attending. Thank you. That's a good question. So the question is left brain, right brain people. I feel that has been sort of become a bit of a myth. We use all of our brain. Just to say another myth, that we use 10% of our brain, that is also not true, right? We use all of our brain. Imagine our brain just having like empty real estate up there just waiting around. So we use all of our brain, but there are some people that use, you know, because the brain is not the same in both hemispheres, and this is a really long discussion. There are books about this, but some of our brain is more language oriented, like the left side of our brain. Our right side of our brain has better spatial abilities. There are some people that use some parts of their brain more effectively than others, not just in left and right, in the front and the back too. So there's lots of variability, but I don't know of any evidence that left brain versus right brain in terms of real memory. Right brain might be more spatial memory, left brain might be more language related memories, but on an individual basis, not so clear. Well, there's lots of ways to record brain activity. SPECT is certainly a respectable and fine way of recording it. PET is another. What we do is functional MRI. So we take advantage of the high spatial resolution of the MRI to see on a much more detailed level than any other technique where things are occurring. It depends on the nature of your question. You know, for some of the questions that seem to be asking, I think SPECT is appropriate. But for what we're doing, we're looking for detailed circuitry of how the brain works, and fMRI is really, as of now, probably one of the best tools for that. But, you know, tools are tools, and they come and go. So we're trying to always find the next thing to explore in more detail.
And the one in the center? Yes.
That is a great question.
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, the question is why? Why do we have a decreased ability to suppress as we get older? We have several grants looking at that right now through the NIH. We think that the circuitry involved in suppression might be especially fragile to getting older. There's a part of your brain called the thalamus, which is deep in the brain, and that might be involved in suppression. And some of the connections from the front part of your brain, which does both sides of the coin, enhancement and suppression, might go through the thalamus, and that part might be very susceptible to those white matter lesions as people get older. A lot of this is speculation, and that's what we're trying to research. No one knows the answer to that. Some of it might also be just strategy and practice. If you're not practicing your ability, you know, to function in this way, to really sculpt how you perceive the world around you, these abilities might decline. And that's why we think that through training, people can improve these abilities. But it might need to be coupled with neurotransmitters that decline, like the cholinergic system is also seems to be involved in suppression. So it's probably multifactorial of structural changes, functional and strategic changes, and also chemical changes. So unfortunately, it's going to be complicated, but that's what we're trying to figure out.
Okay, did you already ask a question before? I'm trying to be fair here. Did you already ask a question in a previous? No? You did. I probably have to go to somebody new. Okay, you and then you.
The, I have a completely uneducated solution to that.
Perfect.
When you told us that we were not being tested on the pictures, I didn't believe you. That's a learned response. And the older you get, you realize that there are things that you should be focusing on. But you know what? Later on, your husband will say, "Well, do you remember that?"
Yeah, so that is not an uneducated point. That is an excellent point, and one that I have heard and thought about a lot. There are some researchers that think the data that I showed you is actually an advantage of getting older, in that you tend to hold just more global information. I find that hard to say because they clearly decline on the task at hand, and that seems to be related to ignoring. We spend a lot of time, you know, the reality is it is not the truth because we do ask them about those scenes after the fact. But during the experiment, it becomes quickly apparent that we only test you on the things that are relevant. Also, people do get the, if you did a lot of those trials, you would realize that your ability to do well does, it is reliant on ignoring. It only takes like three trials for you to actually feel what happens when you don't. So I think we do this question. I think most of our older subjects actually do ignore it, but it is a really good point. And that's sort of what I said about the strategy and how people change as they get older in lots of ways. It's an excellent point, and it's what's so fascinating about studying aging and all, you know, those complexities that exist.
Well, I wish we could. There's people in the back room going like this, so we can't take any more questions. Dr. Ghazali will be available for more questions. So right now, I'm going to thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Very much.